again, we're coming to you from the trenches. I'm Bree Hayden.
The policies of this administration, regardless of whether we like them or not, or the Democrats, Republicans, because there isn't a lot of difference in some of the policies or what they agree upon in terms of Romney and Obama.
Coming up, we'll hear excerpts from a recent Chicago radio panel on elections, corporations, money, media, and the Chicago scene. Another election in the United States has come and gone, and with some putative gains for progressive-minded people. A more diverse Congress on dimensions of race, religion, and sexuality, referenda gains in various states regarding marijuana and same-sex rights, and even referenda on corporate involvement in elections. But, as the saying goes, the more things change, the more they stay the same. A flood of corporate money and corporate ads warp the political process and have held their ground against efforts at reform, including aspiring third-party entrants. Meanwhile, social problems worsen on a range of issues from education to the environment. These and many other issues took center stage on November Decision 2012, a political discussion which aired on Election Night 2012 on Chicago's WHPK radio. We'll spend the hour listening to excerpts from November Decision, which was moderated by WHPK host and From the Trenches' own Mitchell Stipinchik, and with WHPK radio host Mario Smith. The panelists included Pat Hill from the African American Police League, Gabriel Piamonte from the Hyde Park Herald newspaper, and Alex Alvarado, a student from Northeastern Illinois University.
Well, one thing that's been on a lot of people's attention with regards to what in some states could be a close election, close race, what might be broadly termed voting anomalies. Things like, for example, reduced early voting days in both Ohio and Florida that's been seen as a kind of suspicious maneuver or seen as suspicious by both the Republican Secretary of State in Ohio as well as a Republican Governor, Rick Scott, in Florida, reducing that because they know that that has proven to be decisive in past elections. Things like long lines that we have seen in both Ohio and Florida of voting people waiting upwards of 6 or 7 hours to stand in line to finally vote. The Voting Rights Act, which is recent legislation, which is propelled 23 states to have election monitors on site, including here in Chicago and Cook County, it turns out. As well as, unbelievable as it may sound, international election monitors from Europe. The OSCE, International Body of the Organization of Security and Cooperation in Europe, has actually sent monitors into the United States to watch this election. So, unbelievable as it may sound, that is now also in play. This is basically part of, at least what could seem to me to be, my opinion on this, is that it's kind of a last-ditch effort by probably right-wing elements, the Republican Party and so forth, who are trying to delay the inevitable regarding the wagon they've hitched in themselves regarding demographics and racial politics in the United States. So I'm reading these as their attempt to try to forestall the inevitable. It might work in some places, it might not. These are my thoughts. Pat Hill, let's start with you. What do you think?
Where do I start? I guess I'd like to start with the situation in Ohio and Florida. I find it ironic that in this election, Republicans are complaining, especially with all the shenanigans that they were engaged in during the Bush elections. You remember that with the Secretary of State and Jeb and everybody. But I don't see, you know, we've been watching this a lot with the anticipation. Most people are anticipating Barack Obama getting another term. And I think most of us pretty much believe that's going to happen. However, I don't see Ohio and Florida at this juncture really, aside from having that decisive number of electoral votes, have any opportunity to engage in any of that stuff because everybody is, to use the term, hip to their game. And if they do, it's going to be very subversive and it's not going to be as blatant. But I think the Democrats were pretty smart, at least the Obama campaign was pretty smart in encouraging this early voting. And my understanding, and there was a lot of street money out here to make sure that that happened. We refer to it as money in the bank.
What do you, street money?
Street money is money, ground money. Money that makes sure that people get to the polls, make sure that a lot of these, well, we're really not supposed to say it, but anyway, a lot of these places are functioning, up and functioning. Even though that's the responsibility of those jurisdictions and municipalities, you could believe the Democratic Party had a lot to make sure, it was in their best interest to make sure that that happened.
Of course.
And so it takes money to do that. It was remarkable to see how people knew where to go to early vote, and they came. People being bussed in, especially the elders. I mean, that's not free. And so no one is really talking about how did that happen and those long lines. It was almost as if people were determined, even though they had Tuesday and they had all those other days, they were determined on that day that they were bussed in or went to early vote to stay there that day. People generally are not that motivated. And so I'm not sinister and everything, cynical and everything that I see, but I am kind of suspicious. That raised my ire because I've seen a lot of elections. And so I would say that there was some very sophisticated maneuvering going on that really was under the radar. A lot of people didn't pay attention to. And so if the Republicans do try to do anything, like I said, they can go pull out all those absentee votes. They can pull out the early voting votes. And it's like money in the bank to ensure that he will make that, was it 270?
270 is the number of electoral votes needed
to
win the
presidency. Right. He has the popular vote. But that electoral process is going to be a little difficult.
Quite. Gabriel Piemonte, let me throw it to you. Pat Hiller talked about some of the aspects as to how this had happened. Do you see any details on the ground with what you've been seeing as far as exactly how that happened? Could it be that Citizens United unleashed a torrent of money from corporations into paying for buses to help to bring people in, or are other factors here at play?
Well, I think one factor that will be clearer and clearer, I think, as time passes, is exactly how much superior the Obama operation is to the strategists that have come before, Republican or Democrat. I think this is by far one of the most sophisticated and savvy operations that we've seen in this country. Whether we're talking about their ability to connect to people online and through social media, or as Pat was talking about, in probably most importantly, that ability to not only do the sort of the high tech stuff, but the low tech stuff, to make sure that people are getting, getting out to vote, doing whatever it takes to do that, and not in an arrogant or boastful way, but even when it's most appropriate, completely under the radar, not talking about what money has to go where, what people have to get into, what vehicles to drive, who where, but just get it done and just make sure that it happens. Honestly, it has surprised me that the mainstream media has been has been tricked into this narrative of the tight race, when for an extremely long time now, for certainly weeks, and I would say for months, it's been clear that the Obama operation knew exactly where the electoral votes were, the Electoral College, where they needed to concentrate their energy, and they did that. And they've been very successful. And again, to echo Pat, really thinking about all of the ways in which they're able to mobilize their constituents in terms of absentee voting and in terms of early voting. And I think part of the response, what you're seeing with the Republican campaign and its response is a kind of muted hysteria, recognizing that this is a very unimaginative operation, and so they can only do more of the same. They can only do more disenfranchisement. They can't give you new ideas when the whole premise of what they're trying to do is actually to roll back the progress that we made.
I can't dispute that in any way, but I kind of want to go back on this thing with how the corporate mainstream media dealing with this. It's really a roost. You have to realize that they have to keep us interested. Mm-hmm. If they told the truth and said, look, this is really no race, like Dick Gregory often says, they tell you what to think. Mm-hmm. They have to create these scenarios of intrigue. They have to make it a mystery, just like watching a movie, just like, you know, a miniseries or something. So they make up stuff. And I think it's really deceptive by design, because, again, they are corporations. And I think what we really have to explore in some detail is how corporate versus democracy, mm-hmm. because that's a concern. I think, if nothing else, for me, has been highlighted clearly, is that democracy is definitely on the run. And the corporations, the movie was on not too long ago, Network.
Mm-hmm. Yes.
And
from
I think
1976.
That needs to, every generation needs to see that movie.
Yes.
At least 10 times. Because I think now it's firmly planted. Mm. You can look at the policies of this administration, regardless of whether we like him or not, or the Democrats, Republican, because there isn't a lot of difference in some of the policies or what they agree upon in terms of Romney and Obama. But I think we really need to deal with the role of these corporations, how that's going to impact us, our corporations, individuals, corporations, all of this crazy talk. But the reality of the matter is the media, and no offense to anybody, are white, male, own corporate entities.
They have been. In fact, I've actually given lectures and have recorded this as well on the Ministry of Truth. That you just basically summarized the last 170 years, for the most part, of American media in the United States.
But now you can see it a little. Of course, nothing happens overnight. But the manifestation of that is there.
Right. No. I mean, now it's basically laid bare for practically everyone to see. It's,
exactly.
The emperor has no clothes, and everyone knows that now.
And people don't know what to do.
Well, I mean, that actually might be the role that politically engaged citizens would help to fill. It's like, okay, now what?
Yeah.
And in fact, that actually should be the debate that might be fomented between elections. Obviously,
if
everyone's interested in, you know, politics gets front and center stage tonight. Mm-hmm. And maybe if some things might happen, in fact, in Ohio, they're going to have a late provisional ballot hearing on November 17th. So, yeah, there'll still be political news to come, which will get some attention, of course. But you're right, is after tonight, barring another, you know, insane Florida scenario where they held the election up for something like 56 days, that's going to be, politics will more or less drop off the radar of everyday citizens. Mm-hmm. But nonetheless, that kind of political involvement about, okay, yeah, things suck, and a lot of people now know why they suck. But what do you do about it, and where do you go from here? What would be that vision for a better tomorrow? There was a ballot initiative having specifically to do with the involvement of corporate money within elections, and which everyone I had mentioned this to just seemed like it was a no-brainer. Well, yeah, obviously. Why not? And it kind of strikes me that something like that is very powerful, because I don't know exactly what the polling is on this initiative has been, but I would imagine something upwards in the 90th percentile in other similar initiatives around the country where polling has been done. It wouldn't surprise me that Illinois, especially one that has consistently been Democratic and will probably be a lock for the Obama campaign as it goes, we'll see as this plays out. Pat Hill, tell me your thoughts with regards to this initiative, and have you heard anything about it?
I mean, I saw it on the ballot, and I remember the discussion. And in terms of, I don't know, if you look at traditional Democrat, traditional Republican, you would think that this would be something that the Republican Party would be more in favor of and would be pushing, in my opinion. But again, there doesn't seem, as time goes on, there's not as much difference between, again, certain initiatives. I mean, you got the Demo-Publicans and the Republicrats. Well, I mean, what's the difference? So I would suggest that people, especially the last two generations, they don't know any other type of politics.
Right. Why do you think that Republicans would be apt to would be more willing to support this than Democrats?
Well, I mean, stereotypically, they're the money party. They're the party that says that, you know, if it takes however much amount of money to win or whatever. I mean, it's endless. It's no end. It's no bottom to the well. Democrats historically sometimes are viewed to be a little bit more social oriented, and so that's changed. I mean, I'm waiting for the social initiatives or the human rights initiatives. I'm waiting for the civil rights initiatives, something that pushes us back towards humanity. But everything, again, if we talk about corporate, then you got to talk about money. So there's right. not going to, you can't turn this back now. I mean, it's just going in that direction. The train has left the track or the station, and that's it. So how you either get on board, but what it does is it discourages, in my opinion, good people from running. Because you can't raise the money.
Right.
Such as myself and others.
Absolutely.
I wouldn't run another campaign because I would have to take money where I don't want to take money.
And you would then be beholden to those who loaned you the money.
And so you're going to get on the, what is it, you get the amount of justice you can afford.
Yeah.
You're going to get the type of politicians that you paid for.
Right. And I mean, arguably you can say that that's the case, but now it's particularly acute. Oh. And particularly more so with the phenomenon that some people refer to as the revolving door, mm-hmm. But which I unfortunately like to sometimes refer to as the water slide. Politics is a stepping stone toward high, very well paid, and basically removed from any kind of public scrutiny or even awareness, positions of power within larger corporations. Mm-hmm. Within the media work that I've done, I've seen this acutely. Like, for example, I'll mention one example. Michael Powell, name ring a bell?
Colin's son?
That's right. Colin Powell's son, who served as the chair of the FCC for about 6 years.
Correct.
And who, you know what he did after leaving the FCC? What is he doing right now? Anyone know?
I have no idea.
He is the president of the National Cable Telecommunications Association. He is the chief lobbyist for the cable TV industry, for their biggest lobby. So, and in fact, he set up his alignment into that very smartly, in order to make sure that he could do that and basically remove himself from any kind of critical scrutiny. He left the FCC to actually become an analyst at I think it's a bond trading firm, where we actually specialized in media, oddly enough. And so he was basically a stock analyst, mm-hmm. and then moved his way into closer to political lobbies. And then not only did he make the leap into it, he came full on. And that's just one example. Mm-hmm. I mean, within just the FCC, which is something I know a whole lot of, I actually linked to one friend of mine on the website DIYmedia.net. Where he lists a blog post from a number of years back where he basically went through the list of just the chairs of the FCC and what did they do after they left. All of them, with one exception, a gentleman named Michael Copps, who just retired and actually going into nonprofit advocacy work, all of them go into the very industry, the corporate media that they had supposedly regulated as an executive or as a lobbyist or as a lawyer or as... in the case of Michael Powell, president of the cable industry, practically. Yeah. Gabo Piemonte, in the grand big scheme of things, these seem like unbelievably huge things to try to attack. But nonetheless, we can sometimes see in smaller scale efforts to things to try to help to turn the tide a little bit that in aggregate with other efforts can move things forward, as Pat Hellard referred to sooner. In your experience as working with the Hyde Park Herald, what kinds of things have you seen lately that kind of suggest this, or is this even a trend that you're seeing?
Well, it's an interesting question as to whether or not it's a trend. What it's been like to have Barack Obama as the president is an interesting phenomenon for advocates around issues of social justice, because there has been a sort of wait and see. A lot of conversations, you know, a year into his first term, saying, "Oh, give him another year." Then, give him, you know, wait till the next election.
Yeah. And now sounds like Clinton.
We're hearing that again. Right. And we saw what happened with Clinton.
Right.
But I have in my experience in covering the South Side of Chicago. The Hyde Park Herald, of course, covers Hyde Park, but the Lakefront Outlook covers the community of Bronzeville, which is north of and a little bit west of Hyde Park. And I have witnessed multiple times the phenomena of just seeing a small number of people who are just absolutely focused on a goal when everybody around them is telling them it's not you know, whatever they want is just not going to happen. The powerful interests are just too powerful. They're being naive. Things are just going to stay always the way. And then things change. Sometimes they don't change. Sometimes people do get run over. But often, and there are numerous examples of this, and for some reason I'm thinking of DuSable High School right now,
yes,
which was going to be closed and demolished, and was sort of a test case of what became a policy that ran rampant across Chicago, and now it looks like is going to be national policy, where there's this top-down decision to close schools for very odd, even contradictory reasons, but under this rhetoric and rubric of turning around a school or putting a school through an intervention for the good of the kids, mm-hmm. where there's this sort of Orwellian, you know, get rid of all the kids so we can save all the kids school.
As someone who runs a show called The Ministry of Truth,
you understand.
Orwell is well represented.
And so that sort of thing, you know, you see those small groups of people saying, I see what's happening, even if other people are telling me I'm crazy, I'm going to fight against this. And that sort of a fight, building support and eventually leading to successes. So that does happen. I think it would be interesting for us to talk a little bit about that within the context of a second Obama administration.
I have a hard time believing that young people aren't interested, as we talked about earlier.
Quite.
I have a hard time believing that minorities, blacks and Latinos, aren't interested and not willing to vote again. That's the craziest sounding thing I've ever heard. And I think they've done a wonderful job of masking the truth. But now that we know that they systematically lied about this entire ordeal, what do you guys think we need to do in order to make sure that this type of thing doesn't happen again? Because this is horrible on its face. It's absolutely horrible.
Let's throw that question to Alex Alvarado to start.
Well, Mario, I think if you're referring it to Illinois or Chicago in general, which is obviously there's a great minority population here, you know, demographically, a lot of young people, hipsters, etc., all coming, you know, in all forms and shapes and sizes. what ends up really happening is I think that in a sense, being democratic, so democratic here, I think that Obama had sort of in a way neglected to do any major campaigning here, you know, figuring, well, we have this in the bag. And I think that even if that's the case, you still have to advertise, if you will, that you're here. You can't just take it for granted that, oh yeah, well, you know, I'm in a democratic state. So that way you have some sort of data or information that will go against all of this, you know, bogus news that's coming along. So it's like, okay, well, you know, minorities aren't coming out. Well, Barack says, well, hey, you know, he's the one who actually brought out a great majority of the young voters and minority voters
in 2008.
Yeah, exactly. So, but again, you know, that may be the case then. But in order to keep that going, just like anything else, you know, you have to advertise that. I think that Barack perhaps could do that next time, or anyone else who's interested, rather, I should say.
Yeah.
Barack won't have a next time.
Unfortunately,
but yeah. Anyone
presidents are limited to two terms,
yeah,
but
exactly.
To your point.
But anyone interested in doing that should, you know, never take for granted, you know, exactly the positions that they're in.
Pat Hill. I don't think there's any negative consequence for taking it for granted. It's ironic when Mario gave the score, you repeated it, you said welcome to the football game or whatever. But politics is a spectator sport for most people.
Right.
And this to me is, this election, 2008 and this election to me epitomizes that, in the sense that I spend a lot of time around young people, and many young people had never voted. They were old enough. I'm talking about young people. Mm-hmm. In my age, anybody under 50 is young, and under 60 is young. But so it, what you have here is a Mario Samo, so that it never happens again. It's going to happen again because the way people have become accustomed to where they get their information and how they get their information from that white male corporate media, and it's tailored a certain way where the mindset, it doesn't cater to your mindset. You catch up to how it's delivered and you get used to. I'll give you an example.
Right.
For example, I was telling my college students that last year I taught in high school, and that they're teaching these children to test, teaching them to test, and they do ACT format, that when you talk to them, if you don't raise questions in an ACT format, they get very frustrated. They don't know how to decipher, how do I take that question and make it a regular type of question.
In other words, how to think.
That's inductive and deductive reasoning. So
wait a second, no.
the point is, that's what's happening in mass.
Quiet.
People are not thinking, they're regurgitating this message.
Yeah.
And it's like a cow chewing his cud.
Right. The numbers bear out, at least for the time being, that that's true. In fact, when you actually look at what people are saying with regards to what media resources do people use the most for finding out about things, for the moment, it's still TV and newspapers, at least for the time being. The internet is now in second place, and it's unlike both TV and newspapers are on a growth trajectory, and maybe in within another election cycle or two may well exceed that. And where a lot of people might find out about information, for example, from posts from their friends on Facebook, rather than less so CBS News, for example. So that might help to mitigate that kind of impact, or at least down the road, even if less so now. Do you think that the concern with regards to corporations is still valid?
Of course.
In spite of this? Are there concerns to be raised, even though we might see a little bit of a more emerging of a grassroots media and people creating their own media involvement?
Again, the grassroots media, for the most part, the blogging and the political aspects of it, it's on a higher level that I find than the New York Times. It's on a higher level than the Chicago Tribune. So that means you're eliminating a lot of people.
Quite.
Okay, so you're reducing the numbers. So yeah, that should be a concern.
Okay, on the matter with regards to violence in Chicago, I will mention one, well, let's talk about that, and then we can talk about one other interesting event that's going on in Chicago downtown at Grant Park, which we'll get to. But going back to the issue with regards to violence and murder, and especially this past summer, where this was a huge political hot potato for certainly the mayor, for the local political scene, and where this concern about, frankly, people and kids are getting shot in what probably are record numbers, and this is horrible. And It seemed like to me, reading a lot of the coverage about it, is that nobody denied it was happening, but it seemed like there was precious little in the way of trying to get at some of the causes of why this is happening. And maybe folks here in this panel can help to enlighten me and our listening audience about this. Would anyone like to chime in?
Go ahead.
Pat Hill.
Pat Hill.
You had the name. Ladies first.
Richard M. Daley. Totally and completely ineffective leaderless police department.
Okay.
And John Burge.
John Burge being the former police commander
in Area
right.
2.
Right.
And you have to look at the time.
Okay. And also, I should explain for listeners who may be unfamiliar, especially since we're streaming globally, John Burge has been implicated and, in fact, has gone to jail over a police torture ring that he was in charge
actually,
of.
Actually, he went to jail on obstruction.
That's true.
He's never actually been indicted. Or prosecuted,
yeah.
Or convicted for torture.
That's right. He went to jail for 4 years on perjury charges related to that. Right. Never actually on the torture of which the statute of limitations has run out. But nonetheless, it is a critical factor regarding him serving time in the pokey.
Correct.
So, but
he lied
but anyway,
the disposition on the civil suit that was filed by one of the torture victims.
Quite. So,
and that's one of the reasons why they won't depose Daley, because he would be put in the same position.
And Daley had played, I think it was state's attorney before he became mayor.
He was a state's attorney.
Right.
And he received a direct correspondence from the police chief at the time, Brezak, informing him of torture being committed against one of the arrestees that Burge and his guys had arrested and was taken to Cermak Hospital. And the doctor verified it, and Daley has no knowledge of any of this stuff. But when you allow something to continue over 30 years, and it's gets so much exposure, and he being a high-ranking police official who people are constantly told the police are there to serve and protect. And you watch, it's kind of like what happened with Nixon, in our generation with Nixon, but this is more local. And you look at the parents of these young people are now, well, the parents of the children who are doing this now. This is three generations. There's no confidence in the system. They know that the wrong people are going to be prosecuted, or people who have the clout are not going to go to jail. And so a lot of people say, well, what does that have to do with them shooting each other? Well, they're not going to leave Park Manor and go to Beverly. You don't. White people kill white people, black people kill black people, Latinos kill Latinos. You kill who's closest to you.
Right.
And it's a rage. It's a negative rage. And so this is, I think, society, especially the political system, the social justice system, the education system in this city has really let the citizens down. This city, if you recall, when several members of many of our organizations went to the UN and the Committee Against Torture in the United Nations declared Chicago as a torture capital of the United States based on Burbage. I mean, torture is an international term. Torture. Not police brutality.
Right.
Not racial profiling. Torture.
Right.
And so that has manifested in this lawlessness with these killings. But you also have to look at the accessibility to guns.
Yeah, certainly.
Now, if they were killing with hatchets and knives and ice picks and stuff, because the motivation is there. But it's being facilitated with being able to get your hands on these guns quickly. These are not guns that have been in the family a long time. These are brand new guns.
Right.
And they're coming in here by the cases.
Right.
What accounts for the easy access to guns?
Well, it's easy access because of the corruption. And I'm saying that don't think for a moment that there are officials of the police department who don't know. They know.
Of course.
Okay, so you have a inherently corrupt system of policing. You have an administrative, the mayor picks the police chief. The latest police chief, he doesn't have a clue. And his history prior to coming to Chicago indicates he doesn't have a clue.
Gary McCarthy?
McCarthy. But yeah. What's even worse, my organization, African American Police League, I met with the progressive caucus of the city council prior to his confirmation. We gave them all of the information. They stated to us very frankly, you are probably right, but we're going to confirm him. When you have your public elected officials having the proper information and not having the good conscience or the guts to do the right thing, that in itself, like I said, the whole system is corrupt. And their position was, well, you know, we want our garbage picked up. We want this. Well, that just also shows how ignorant they are of their roles as aldermen. So we have a system in Chicago that, in my opinion, serves as the worst example possible of how a municipality should work.
Gabriel Piemonte, in light of this circumstances of the evidence that are going on, what might be some things that folks who are interested in trying to help to change that circumstance in the city of Chicago might want to try to do to help to remedy that? Should they try to, you know, run for alderman themselves, or should they get organized in other political manifestations? What do you think?
Well, I think Pat's absolutely right that it is a system of violence that we're dealing with, and the most important is the most immediate and cruelest violence and its development over generations. It's also true that we live in a time of economic violence. So
yes.
People who are chronically unemployed, people who are unemployed by the willful decision of the system, so that, you know, if we drop below 5% unemployment, newspapers like the Wall Street Journal panic and say we've got to have a certain unemployment rate to make people happy. This is a system
make investors happy.
That, yeah, right, right. To make people who care about money instead of people happy.
Right.
This is a system that is. People who tune out don't tune out just because they're sort of apathetic or stupid, or we shouldn't assume the worst of people who aren't engaged. A lot of them are making a willful decision or doing it based on a really profound intuition, which is, where do you start? is a sense that from the moment you walk out the door and you can't be sure how you're going to be, you know, assaulted or accosted, whether it's through the virtual violence of commercials and advertising, or the very real violence from your neighbor or from the people who are supposed to be protecting you, you get to a point where all of the information is garbage, and so you choose to do nothing. So where you start is on a very small level. You start block by block. You start with your immediate neighbors, maybe in your building, and then go from your building to your block, and then hopefully at some point it grows out to your neighborhood. But what's missing, the reason that doesn't happen, is I think that there is a fundamental lack of confidence in people's ability to affect change. And that's to me the nut to crack. That's the real challenge, is how do you convince people? And maybe I'm you know, turning this question back to you, Mitch, how do you convince people that they can affect change?
And my experience, over having been involved at least in the realm of media politics of the last decades, is you show them an example of how that kind of grassroots activism has made a difference. I've been very lucky to be involved with groups and campaigns that have made that on various issues. Oddly enough, it's actually the kind of thing where you can't exactly point to. I'll mention an example. In 2003, we had fought for and wound up winning a fight to stop the erosion of the last remaining media ownership rules, which, if they had been gone, would have basically, within a matter of months, radically transformed our media into, people are complaining about it now, it would have been much worse had this passed, had the FCC regulations that got that not gotten blocked in both Congress and in the court order that actually still stood for about 7 years. In the wake of that, but the problem with something like that is, A, you got to explain it to them, because it's not the kind of thing that people is getting covered a whole lot because of the media, who have a vested interest in the outcome. But B, the it takes a long time just to explain. There's nothing hard about it. It's just that you have to build it step by step to explain the process of what happened, and then, you know, people are half asleep at that point a lot of the time. But nonetheless, examples like that are the bread and butter of how you, at least in my opinion, you show that, yes, you can make a difference. You can fight City Hall. You can fight these giant corporate behemoths that seemingly control everything. But nonetheless, you can fight and win, and we've seen examples of that. I've been lucky enough to live in that time and again. Alex Alvarado, what are some of the things that, in the wake of all this discussion, what are your thoughts about political involvement or trying to fight for change?
Well, I think you certainly hit upon, you know, the most important point. Is that yes? There is this there is an ability to make change. It was something that took me quite a while to realize. But as you get a little bit older and you get a little bit wiser, you get a little more educated, you start to realize that, you know, all these things such as the street violence, you really do see the sources why they're happening. And believe me, I've come across it from people that I know personally. You know, they'll sit there and talk, well, hey, you know, I'm not working at this point, maybe I should do something illegal. you know, and of course, I mean, you know, it could be jokingly, and at the same time, some people do have a deep-seated thought about that sort of thing. And so you see those kinds of patterns, you know, just as a simple example on why people would turn to this sort of violence. And of course, you know, I'm not here to say that all my pals are poor and, you know, they're criminals or anything like that, but I mean even female jokes about how to make money in the corner, you know, all that kind of stuff does
right.
come up. I mean, it's a genuine issue. But getting back into say a neighborhood point, I like what you said was should people run for alderman? Well, my answer is yes. I think that far too long the city of Chicago has placed itself, which I'm a native and I've seen this growing up, you know, all of my entire life, right in the city. How these, you know, the career politicians, you know, they're just there. They're just these figureheads that are in all these kinds of deals that nobody knows about until somebody gets busted. But then even then, it's just a slap on the wrist, and they continue to do these things, and there are no real changes that people want to see. You know, even if it's something as simple as getting your streets cleaned or your sidewalk fixed. Mm-hmm. And so this does create an element of frustration and anger. And the way to go, and the real way to go here, is to get out and vote, is to run for these offices, is to figure out a way how to, in a sense, infiltrate the system. I mean, because at this point, with the political system. I mean, this is the People's Republic of Chicago. This is, you know, this is its own, you know, entity.
Right.
And I've never seen so much corruption in all my life. Mm. And it's probably at its apex at this point. You know, and having said that, with that going on, and every more people more and more coming aware, it ends up that, say, for instance, the political system, as well as Chicago Police Department, no offense, Pat, you know, they all, you know, they all have a deficit of trust that needs to be repaid. Mm.
I received a press release from the Occupy Chicago Press Release Committee with regards to an event that I don't know if they organized, but they certainly have done some efforts to promote. A public burning of voter registration cards taking place at Grant Park in Michigan and Congress by the statue. It began at 6 o'clock. It might actually still be going on. I have to admit, I don't know. And if folks who are there can call in, we'd be happy to take a call. Reading some of the announcement details about this event. I'm kind of divided about this, and I'd like to hear what the panel has to think. On the one hand, it's kind of that, you know, feeling of giving a middle finger to the system. Yes, there's a lot of corruption about the system, and a lot of ways you can argue voting just helps to cement that. And it's not that kind of, on a lot of the changes that you can point to in recent and in distant history that have made a difference in improving people's lives have come outside of the ballot box and less so within it, some may argue. On the one hand, a lot of people have fought and bled and died for the right for the franchise. I mean, I mentioned the example. Susan B. Anthony voted in the 1876 election for Ulysses Grant and was fined $100 for that, and she never paid it. But nonetheless, through efforts in the subsequent 40 years, was finally in 1920 to be able to earn the right that she had fought for, along with a lot of other people, for the right to extend the franchise to half the population in the United States, women. So, voting. Are the protesters who might be willing to give a middle finger to the system right, or are they throwing away a privilege that they think they should use, even if in some nominal sense now? What do people think?
You know,
Alex.
I'm going to go back to exactly what we were just talking about. It's this kind of misinterpretation about what voting really is. I mean, everyone says, "Oh, why vote? It doesn't matter." Blah blah blah. There's so much of that has been, you know, ingrained or institutionalized, even, you know, in the mindset of I would say a great group of many, especially younger voters. And this sort of thing, I'm sure, I'll be quite honest in saying this myself, that I would love to give the finger to the system myself.
Absolutely.
But by burning my voter's registration card and not voting and not participating in engaging the monster that's actually beating me up, that's a definite loss. There's no way to win by doing that. So, you know, what they're doing, you know, in my viewpoint is it's certainly a spectacle, but it's not effective in making those changes and turning around this political system.
Symbolism.
Pat Hill.
Symbolism is really important, but usually, and I'm from the 60s, I've been a little confused sometimes at what Occupy Chicago and Occupy America and Occupy is trying to say. I support resistance. But whenever you create a void, you have to be prepared to fill it.
Right.
So I'm not certain what they're doing this for. So I don't have enough information. One of the things about touting this thing called democracy, one of the most important aspects of democracy is the freedom to express yourself through open and fair elections. So maybe they're making a point that these elections are not open, maybe they're not fair. I mean, Debo showed us that in a couple of elections and the rigging these machines.
And
I agree with that, right. And of course, what black people had to go through in the South with the poll tax and how many bubbles in it. So I understand that. But I think what they tend not to do is educate when they do these things. I don't know why they're burning them. It's like back in the day when the men burned draft cards. We
right.
understood why.
Right.
They were against Vietnam War. They were against the war, and we understood why. It had been articulated why. So maybe if they can come and explain to us, because I'm not against anything that is progressive. I just don't know what the point is. So that's what I need to know.
Gabriel Piemonte.
Yeah, I would agree with Pat, and I think you start by sort of getting at the heart of what it is, which is symbolic. And in my opinion, we have plenty of symbolism. We don't need anything else symbolic.
We need some substance.
We need substance. if instead of burning their cars, they wanted to not pay taxes because taxes go to a war machine, then you've done something that's substantial civil disobedience, and there are real consequences for that.
Yes.
And I think absent the consequences, we've seen so much of this sort of, I am doing this to represent my dissatisfaction or to represent what I would like to happen. There's so much of that happening right now that it's either not really worth that much or worse, it's really disorienting to people who, and I feel very similar to how Pat had articulated her feeling. We don't really understand what the alternative that's being presented is. And without understanding whether there's an alternative, you can reach the conclusion there isn't one.
And also the back and forth with the electoral vote is very interesting because as more results come in, it's like Romney's up now.
Yeah, it's a horse race.
It's
right. Absolutely. No, I mean, you might as well be watching the score of a football game.
Yeah.
In a lot of ways.
Well, technically, you are.
And in a lot of ways, you are. In fact, you can even go further than that. John Nichols from The Nation, who's a friend of mine, he remarked in the lecture in 2004, talking about the electoral votes then, about doing an experiment where you could take that year's coverage of the Super Bowl and play it side by side by that year's coverage of the election returns. Mm-hmm. Same graphics, same scoreboard along the bottom, mm-hmm. same running commentary by people who think they know what they're talking about. Sometimes they do
they
more in the football
being.
Sense, I think.
Right.
Phil Sims actually has played in the Super Bowl.
I also would like to just let everybody know that we are going to address some of the Illinois races because there's some doozies because I saw every commercial and I swear I'm so glad on so many different levels that tomorrow is the 7th of November. You do not have to watch
not
about
the least of it.
Bill Foster
this is there. Here's a statistic
anymore.
That is going to blow your mind, and I know that it's hard to do.
Yes.
As far as outside money when it comes to house races, Illinois is second in the country.
Really?
$43.5 million of outside money, according to analysts who have looked at this and crunched the numbers from what we can discern so far. There's still a lot of dark money, as it's called, that has not been accounted for. But for what has been accounted
well,
for.
Well, what do you know? Yeah. They came up with a name for that.
Astronomers have found the source of dark money in the middle of the galaxy.
All the names you can come up with, right.
No, this is the term that is now.
I gotta get me a super PAC Mitchell Stone. I'm screwing up
But there's a serious point to be made about this, and it's very frightening. There's been almost nothing, and probably nothing, in the way of presidential electoral votes. No one said, vote for Romney for president on ads, but there's been plenty of ads regarding Duckworth and Walsh, mm-hmm. or Biggert and Foster, or Schilling and Bustos, and on and on and on. At least six competitive House races where that is really in play.
Well, don't we have a governor in jail for selling a seat of a local? Oh, that's a federal seat.
Right.
You know what I'm saying? Illinois is an interest, okay?
Right. But we only trail California, which is the most populous state in the country as far as outside money affecting House races. Illinois is second, precisely because we've got a lot of competitive races with a lot of people at stake, and it becomes this kind of insane jockey of money and influence and a lot of television.
They're going to Congress.
Right, right.
On the violence issue, and to go back to that, I think we would be wise in this city to start listening a little bit with better ears to these young people. Mm. Because and I had this discussion about Chief Keef. And I'm not a fan of his music. I do hear what he's saying, though. And when we talk about people who are voiceless and feel that they're not represented fairly and their voice is a bullet or a gun, that's a problem. I don't think it's a easy problem to address, nor do I think it's a difficult problem to address. But I do believe if we don't start to really pay attention to them, this new political base of young people who may or may not be in jail when it comes time for the next election, may or may not be alive when it comes to the next election, where we talk about this ideology of democracy being something that we are holding on to, so tightly today, especially if you go on Facebook. Oh my God, I didn't know that many people were patriots. With all this patriotism around being able to have a voice and have a say, I think we need to reverse the trend a little bit and fall back and listen to what these young people have to say, because some of it is very valid, and if we don't listen to them, we're going to be victimized by them, and I would hate for that to happen, and it's happening.
I agree, Mario, but I think we also need to look at how they're being empowered and by whom.
And by whom, mm-hmm. exactly.
Young people
right,
right. have always Certainly. Had something to say. Right. I come out of the 60s. Right. I was young in the 60s. And it is how you say what you have to say and whether or not you should be listened to.
True.
Now, if they were not being empowered the way that they're being empowered, accessibility to weaponry,
mm-hmm.
all of this notoriety through this negative music, they're not doing that. The corporations are doing that.
Yes.
And where is the money coming from to buy these guns? See, those guns are not free.
Right.
And they're not being given to them. So right. they are being listened to by someone.
Right.
And what we call the hidden hand, because no one is looking at how they are getting access. Young people have, what they say, it's a shame that something is wasted on the youth.
Youth
what is
it? Wasted on the young.
Yeah, youth is wasted. That's it.
Yeah, right.
And so I'm saying that is something we need to look at.
Redistricting. There, a lot of people were frustrated and didn't know until they actually arrived at what seemed to be their polling place, that it may have not have been their polling place. Mario had read a story in the corporate Chicago Tribune that there have been a lot of instances in which people not having been aware of redistricting and how their new polling place may have been moved or consolidated or eliminated entirely, and then suddenly left high and dry on the one day when they need to vote. So, thoughts on redistricting? I pose that to the panel.
Well,
Gabriel Piemonte.
You know, it's interesting that they're willing to cover the chaos of people not having information about redistricting, but there was precious little information from the mainstream media about where people. This is very basic information: where you have to go, if you're in this precinct, you go to this location. That the locations had changed. It was something that you could find hardly anywhere, and it was a challenge not just there. If there had been a good faith effort on the part of mainstream media to cover this to begin with, they would have realized that it was chaos even in the aldermanic offices. We, in our efforts to inform our little corner of Chicago, have spent the last couple of months trying to get this information. Finally got a map 2 weeks ago that along with the table that sort of let people know, you know, if you're Here's your precinct. Mm-hmm. Now you go to this location. 2 weeks before the election, very little information available for people generally. And we had that information at literally on the same day that the aldermanic offices had it, meaning that they couldn't even get that information out if they wanted to. It was really a disaster, and had the mainstream media been digging to begin with, this would have been really a fascinating story that would have had at least a couple of months of legs, because it's an outrage that people just didn't know where to go to vote.
Going back for a moment regarding that issue regarding the media, not just with regards to the whole flood of ads, but we kind of touched on this earlier regarding the whole phenomenon of if political... The corporate media have and always been corporate from the get-go. The story of how that happened is a story of immense corruption, especially where in the 1920s and 30s, in the setup of radio, there was a pretty serious fight to try to make it far more responsible, and forces on behalf of the public had not been as well organized as they should have, and unfortunately were defeated in their attempts. But nonetheless, the efforts had continued as a big strain of American history that a whole lot of people don't know. And we're seeing the consequences of that playing out now, where the media are basically all but abdicated their role of serving as a conduit of the public and basically seeing people as target markets for advertisers and for sensational stories to help to promote, you know, the iPhone 5 or for anything or anything that, you know, might be up for sale or the latest movie or something to buy, but not, you know, the kind of civic engagement that today of all days it exemplifies. So this, I think, is just another indictment with regards to the media. And you know, this has been my political activism career for the last 10 years. Pat Hill, in what ways might this kind of information deficit and tie into the kind of corporate corruption that we've seen? I mean, certainly the corporate media, major media, are corporations. But in what ways do you see that these kinds of two seemingly disparate threads, the corporate
dimension of things that you've been emphasizing rightly, I think, and this abstract, now this concrete here and now thing about, yeah, people never found out where they need to go to vote. How are those two things tied? Do you see a connection?
Well, first of all, so that we won't be accused of participating in that, I think we need to talk a little more also tonight about not just Obama and Romney, because they were other candidates.
Of course.
And I think that points to what we're talking about, in that you're being steered to believe that there are only two parties.
Of course.
And even though they have all the money, that's why you only believe that, because everybody else can't get television time. But it's obvious what it does and why. I mean, the motivation behind is what we have to understand. It's about the Benjamins. It's not about people being represented, and I keep saying the word, in a democracy. Because truthfully, I don't think this is how a democracy runs. I don't think this is how you really... We have what is called a semblance of it. And I think people enjoy, since they don't know anyway, for the most part. I think we had this conversation a lot about civics having been taken out of schools for a long time. So people don't really know what a democracy is. And all they know is majority rule, which is really not a democracy. The majority gets first term. So I guess what I'm trying to say is that all of this plays directly into what we have that we're complaining about, that we really don't have the wherewithal possibly of how to change it. Because I've watched the gradual acceptance of a lot of this by the people. It's like anything else. If you allow something to go on over time, you become accustomed to it.
Yeah.
It becomes the norm. And if you don't have the opportunity to constantly see an example of the alternative, you don't think one exists. So this is really the norm. And I think one of the basic, the most glaring examples of showing or contradicting this is our foreign policy. Mm-hmm. And of course, most people won't talk about that. I've been very vocal in terms of dealing with Barack Obama's administration's foreign policy, especially when it comes to Africa. And he's from Africa.
Yes.
And so you have to
show
his glaring...
Well, his family, he's from...
Well,
was born in Hawaii.
Half of him is from Africa.
Right. His father was born in Kenya. Okay. But we just wanted to make that absolutely
half
clear.
Of your, him
point
is from Africa.
Your point is well taken,
though. Unless you watch Chris Rock's... Which is really good.
That was genius.
Wow. That was genius.
It is very cool.
I have not seen that. I will make a note to see
you.
Okay.
I will make a point to see that.
But anyway, you were
we
saying.
We digress. But the point that I'm making is that we have to be very vocal about the contradictions. And then even if people do ask, what are you talking about? What are you upset about? Why are you complaining? Because there's a lot of this groupthink out here. A bunch of sheep. And you know the old saying, we're going to hell in a handbasket, you're not paying attention. And so I think if we don't do that, we're all complicit in this, and we're complaining about those who have the money, who have the ability to constantly, you know, have the airwaves. But the internet to me is the best alternative. It's the best alternative. I tell my students that in Northeastern all the time. You can use that. You have control over that. YouTube, to me, is the best invention. And blogging. So as far as alternative or choices, I think we need to start talking about those kinds of things to counter.
Yeah.
And, you know.
And on a lot of the... I'll tie this into one point I had raised earlier. A lot of the wins that we've had from my own experience, having been involved in the politics of media in the United States in the last decade... If we didn't have the internet, I don't think we would have had most, if not any, of those things.
Mm-mm.
I mean, it's simple in 2003. I mean, people were emailing each other, like flyers, in Word format.
Mm-mm.
I mean, people now would have been able to, you know, download a PDF in a sneeze from, you know, Facebook or any of a dozen other different websites. But nonetheless, it was a way to be able to get around that kind of information blockade that the corporations would want to maintain and control to protect their own vested interest, because they have a stake in the outcome, and a big one.
You've been listening to excerpts from November Decision 2012, which aired on Election Night 2012. The full 3-hour audio of the show is available online and linked from Chicago Indie Media's website at chicago.indiemedia.org. That concludes this episode of From the Trenches. To learn more and get involved in making media, including helping to make this radio program, please visit the website of the Chicago Independent Media Center at chicago.indiemedia.org or call 773-384-8544. I'm Bree Hayden. Special thanks to Mario Smith and to the staff of WHPK for audio assistance. And thank you for listening. Be sure to join us again for another episode, From the Trenches.